Today, many households are feeling the pressure, and the election is missing the point. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. Well, there's something weird going on with the current election campaign. It feels like a phony war to me, and I've been very disappointed with the quality of the debate. Okay, they're throwing money left, right and centre, and particular investments in particular locations. But there is really no structural discussion about the true issues specifically relating to household finances and property. Now, I, of course, continue to model what's going on. And today what I want to do is to give you the update for March, which sets the backcloth for my show on Tuesday, where I'm going to be looking at the postcode analysis and specifically ask where are households hurting the most. And by the way, if you'd like me to analyse a particular postcode on Tuesday, feel free to put the postcode in the chat below and I'll make sure it's incorporated. Or you can come on live on Tuesday and ask me then about my latest analysis down to the postcode level. This is a really critical issue because, frankly, I don't believe that politicians have really come to terms with just how many households across the country are in significant financial pressure thanks to many years of bad policy. And frankly, the promises or the aspirations that people are talking about from a political perspective are misaligned with where people actually are and what needs to be done. So what I want to do today is to go into a bit of detail and set up the conversation for Tuesday. And I'm going to do that a couple of ways. The first one is just to highlight the gap. This article, of course, talks about the $90 billion super rout and the likelihood that it will trigger RBA cash rates. And it's certainly quite likely that we will see the RBA reacting. Although, of course, if inflation remains sticky or goes higher, and of course, many people are modeling higher inflation now because of Trump and the tariffs, then it may not be as easy to cut rates. And it'll be this contention between employment, which is still, of course, pretty strong in Australia, and the pressure on the broader economy. I do find it quite interesting that articles like this are still coming out quite often, where the journalists are highlighting how, magically, because of the slight rate cut we've had, prices continue to rise, and the PropTrack people here have come out with more examples of 6% plus rises over the last quarter. And I do certainly recognise that in some parts of the country, particularly houses, we are seeing prices still rise, but they are unaffordable for many people. And the trouble that I see is that if rates are cut by the RBA in response to these global uncertainties and the Trump trade, etc., etc., then what we're going to do is put another rocket under home prices, which are already massively unaffordable. But the problem I've got is it's the rental sector in Australia, which is where the rubber hits the road in terms of financial pressure. And there's been very little discussion through the campaign so far, specifically in the rental sector. Obviously, the strategies need to be to reduce migration significantly to take some of the demand off the rental sector in particular, and also to think about the supply of the right houses in the right place. Unfortunately, that really hasn't gone very well either. And so we are left in this limbo land where the politicians are not actually coming to terms with the true extent of pressure on a very large proportion of households. One third of households plus are in the rental sector. And as we'll see shortly, many of those have huge financial pressures. And just to take that conversation a little further, the ABC published an interactive piece just recently called The Rent Crisis Behind Australia's Two-Faced Cities. And the data that they present and the way they present it is quite innovative. So I'm going to use a couple of slides that they've shown us. But what it's doing is it's highlighting that for some, things are not bad at all, but for many others, particularly in the rental sector, it's a problem. And they use this technique here to highlight that at the start of the pandemic, just 2% of postcodes were out of reach for the average income rental household. Now they're using the 30% or more of household incomes before tax, which is a gross income 30%. I've said for many long months and years that this 30% measure is not very accurate. It doesn't really work, which is why I use a different method for my stress analysis. But nevertheless, they say a few years ago, it was 2%. And then they run it forward and say 4 years later, close to 70% of postcodes are beyond reach in the rental sector, according to the latest data. Actually, 68.7% of postcodes are out of reach. And you can see there the difference between affordable and unaffordable. And they look specifically at the story in Perth, and they showed the shift from 2020 to 2024 in terms of the lower levels of stress versus the higher levels of stress. And certainly I've been modelling increasing stress, particularly in Perth, but elsewhere too, in recent times. And they go on to say that actually this is not a particularly new story in Sydney, which has long excluded certain groups from vast swathes of the city. And here they show, for example, areas of Liverpool, where things are a little more affordable, Rouse Hill less so, Balmain less so, Bondi even less so, and French's Forest in other areas even more unaffordable. And they go on to say that if you look at some of the other cities like Adelaide, where 69% of postcodes are out of reach, or Perth at 68.7%, Sydney 55.1%, and regional Queensland at 50%. The story means that this is not just in the major centres. As they say, it's a similar story across the country, in capital cities and regional areas alike. Average income households are being priced out of the neighbourhoods that they would want to call home. And then they go on to show that if you look at it particularly from the point of view of cohorts, for example, the average rental household income is 55.1% of postcodes out of reach, but single working parents show that 62.1% of properties are out of reach. Remember, we're talking rental here, not owner-occupier. The minimum wage couple, 80% of properties are out of reach. For a single pensioner, pretty much all properties are out of reach. And for a single person on benefits, well, it's just stupidly out of reach. And frankly, this gets to the heart of the issue that I keep coming back to and why I press and continue to press on my modelling. Because I don't think that the political dialogue in Australia is actually sufficiently aligned to dealing with the real pressures on real households. Of course, these are hard questions. And of course, the federal politicians will blame the states. The states will blame everybody else, and nothing much gets done. And no, we can't build our way out of this by simply building high-rise, as I've discussed on previous shows, because this is a structural issue that has been created by years and years and years of bad policy, too high migration, the wrong types of property being built, too freer lending standards, the deregulation of the financial system. I could go on, and I quite often do, on these points. And I think we've got to the point now where these issues are absolutely critical. And if we don't address them, then the social cohesion of society in Australia is in question. And as I'll show you shortly, when you look at my analysis, even new migrants to Australia are being squeezed out of the rental sector, which shows you that the migration question and housing affordability and social cohesion are in fact all linked. So there should be some significant and major policy development in this area, but no, we're talking about minor changes to migration, all very vague and very fuzzy, and frankly, a lack of good dialogue, specifically about rental housing affordability. Now that takes us quite nicely then to my own analysis, and for those who've not seen it before, what we do is we are modelling households. We run surveys, and these surveys run each month, and at the end of each month, we run our core market model, and that takes information from our various sources, including the surveys, other injury data, and we roll it through our model. And we can slice and dice the data lots of different way and try and get a handle on what's going on. Very importantly, I do look at types of people, both in terms of those who are active and inactive in terms of property, particularly the rental sector, and also from a cohort perspective as well as the location perspective. So it's quite granular, and we can slice and dice the data. Think of it like a Rubik's Cube. And the other thing we can do also is to look at some of our scenarios and think about where things may be going later. And if we take the mortgage stress data, the price trajectory and history, the buying and selling intentions, the migration data, the economic data as well, like CPI, wages and employment, put it through the core market model and our scenarios. And then we can look at it at the postcode level, roll it up a region, state and all Australia level, and form a view also of where those housing scenarios may run in terms of price movements. Now, as I'll just say once again, as I always do, if you'd like a specific conversation about a particular suburb, I provide a one-to-one service. I've been very busy with this service recently because a lot of people have been struggling to try and make sense of what's going on. Now, this is an individual confidential conversation, but of course I can't provide specific financial advice, but I can discuss my data for a given suburb or postcode and look at some of the underlying trends. And I can look at the stress data, the home price trend data, and also think about where prices may go based on our modelling. Now, these conversations typically take up to an hour, either by phone or preferably via Zoom, so I can share the slides. And we are unfortunately having to charge for this service because there's a lot of work to be done. I, for example, will reach out for the real estate agents and talk to the local council and things like that when I'm actually looking at particular issues. And I've had some very interesting conversations in recent times with regard to specific locations with specific properties. Now, if you are interested in having a one-to-one conversation with me, feel free to contact me by my blog. Links are below. Spaces are limited simply because there's too much to be done to be doing too many. And I'm booking typically 3 to 5 weeks ahead at the moment, unless there's a really urgent need, in which case I can sometimes accommodate people. So if you are interested, feel free to reach out. Now, coming back to my stress analysis, as I mentioned a little while ago, I don't think that 30% of income, whether it's taxable or gross income, is the full story. And others use underwriting metrics to try and get at stress. But I define stress simply in cash flow terms, money in, money out. If households have more outgoings, excluding one-off discretionary items, than income, we define them as stressed. If they have a mortgage, they're in mortgage stress. If they're renting, they're in rental stress. Investors potentially can have cash flow pressures and could well be identified as stressed investors. And we can aggregate the data to estimate total financial stress down to the postcode level, for example, which is quite interesting if you then map that particularly to the electorates and therefore the political system and process. Now, we can look at it both in percentage terms of households and also the count. I tend to focus in on some of the big numbers because the law of big numbers actually does help to highlight where the hotspots really are. And of course, if you have a lot of people in a particular area with financial difficulty, that puts downward pressure potentially on home prices. Now, the RBA some time ago published this spectrum of household financial stress, and it shows that at the mild end, you start with budget pressures. You potentially can go across towards severe via missing payments and ultimately becoming insolvent. And everybody says, well, insolvency is very low, so there's nothing to see here. Well, that's not really the full story. I measure it at the mild end, cash flow, money in, money out, budget pressures. People are having to make difficult decisions and prioritizing to get by. And of course, the more households that are actually making those hard decisions are actually in the market at any one time. That puts a lot of pressure on the broader economy, which is why the economy is relatively slow at the moment. But it's not the same as insolvency. And insolvency typically can take 3 to 5 years to work through, which is why we're still seeing high levels of insolvency in Western Australia. That was from the last crisis, despite the fact that home prices have been rising quite strongly recently. So let's look at the data to March 2025. I'm going to start with the rental stress. This is the very sad story that I keep telling, and unfortunately, it's not widely reported accurately as just how many households in the rental sector have a problem. It's a big problem. 77.2% of those in the rental sector have a cash flow problem. Now, some of that's been created by the fact that their rents have gone up. The landlords put them up quite regularly. In some cases, it's because of the other financial pressures as well. Because, of course, the cost of food and general living and getting around have also risen. And incomes, although they're up in some areas, many people in the rental sector have not seen their incomes rise very strongly in recent times. If we then look at the mortgage sector, we're at 50.7% of households with an owner-occupied mortgage in mortgage stress. And you can compare that with 32.9% back in February 2020. So you can see there's been a significant rise and a further uptick this month. This is a combination of the higher interest rates that have come through. We had a rate cut, of course, earlier on, but that hasn't really had a major impact. And for many people, their incomes in real terms are still lower than they were a decade ago, despite the government saying incomes are rising faster than inflation. Oh, and finally, the RBA continues to say, well, the debt-to-income ratio isn't too bad at 183, but remember that that is all households, whether they're borrowing, and includes small business, by the way, as well. And if you were to look at those in the mortgage sector in terms of debt-to-income ratio, we are seeing the debt-to-income ratio now about 6 times or even 7 times. Go back 20 to 30 years, it would be 3 times. That is an archetypal indicator of the financial pressure in the system at the moment. Now, if we then look at the March data, this is the latest update. And I've highlighted in yellow where the percentages have risen compared with last month. And you can see there that pretty much across the board, other than South Australia, all states have seen a further rise in mortgage stress. Interestingly, what we saw was a little bit of relief thanks to some of the tax cuts that had come through and also some of the pay rises that have come through, but they really run out of runway now. And so pretty much across the board, it's 50.7% of households in mortgage stress, which is 1.88 million. And it's interesting just to think about the implications of that. 1.8 million households across the country in mortgage stress. If we look at rental stress, other than the ACT in Queensland, which saw small moves, and the WA story, which did see some fall, 77.2% of households in rental stress equate to 2.38 million households in rental stress. Investor stress also went up 17.3%, more than 508,000 stressed investors. These are people who have an investment property, and the cash flow pressures mean that they really are not making any returns. And of course, if prices are rising, maybe they'll be happy with that. But recently, prices were drifting lower. And as a result of that, we saw more investors actually selling their property, which reduced the stock for investors. The question is, how many first-time buyers were able to buy those, or did other property investors hoover them up? And my analysis suggests that quite a lot of it showed investors hoovered up the properties that were being sold. And then finally, the aggregate financial stress metric, which is the combination of mortgage stress, rental stress, and investor stress. And you can see there that 48.1% it went up again from last month. And that relates to 4.77 million households of the 10 million households in Australia. So around half of all households in the country have significant cash flow pressures. Now, that's not a story that the politicians want to talk about, nor indeed is it one where I think policies that are being proposed at the moment are anywhere close to solving it. Frankly, another $150 on electricity will not solve the problem. These endemic structural issues that we have in the country. And it's putting a lot of pressure on a lot of households. And as I said before, the problem with this is that this translates not just into financial pressure, but also into social pressure. So we see things like rising crime rates, family violence, some of the other soft underbelly problems that we see in society. In fact, I've been arguing for some time that social cohesion in Australia is absolutely at risk at the moment, simply because of bad policy. And yet, I don't hear any discussion about that through the political campaign. They've gone back to tactical issues rather than dealing with the strategic issues that I think are so important. And I think that's a disgrace. But unfortunately, pretty much everybody in the political system is playing that game. There are a few minor parties who've been more vocal on issues, but even there, their discussions about the tent cities, for example, and the lack of social cohesion are pretty limited. Why? Well, because actually the voters who are more likely to turn out perhaps are not in this cohort. Maybe they're in another cohort. Maybe they've got lots of property investments. Maybe they're owning their property outright. And of course, there is this other story in Australia. There are people doing fine. There are people with significant pay rises. And so we've got this bifurcation between the haves and the have-nots, between those that are actually within the political system and who are frankly being addressed left, right and centre by the politicians, and those who are outside the system and frankly are being left behind. It's a pretty bad story, I think. Now, what we can do is to look in more detail at the analysis I did, and I'm going to start with mortgage stress. And here is the latest data on mortgage stress. And what I've done here is stack-ranked the particular postcodes, taking account of the number of households deemed to be in mortgage stress on my analysis. And you can see there that Liverpool, 2170, is top of the list, with more than 12,300 households in mortgage stress, which is a high proportion. Campbelltown, 2560, is also on the list there, slightly smaller number, but you can see there a very high proportion. And look, I have an error rate of plus or minus a few percent, but what I'm saying is that pretty much everybody in this area with a mortgage have issues at the moment. Then we go to Western Australia, 6065, and then to Toowoomba, 4350, Roxburgh Park in Victoria, 3064, Camden in New South Wales, 2570, Narre Warren in Victoria, 3805, Berwick and Harkaway, 3806, Pakenham, 3810, back to New South Wales, to Riverstone, 2765, and then Tarnik back in Victoria, 3029, Ballarat, 3350, so regional centre there, as well as Toowoomba, of course, up in Queensland, and then Gundaroo, 2620, and Merriwar in Western Australia. And the thing I want to highlight here is that quite a few of these postcodes are actually these high growth corridors where we've had lots of building of new properties in recent years, lots of people mortgaged to the gills, lots of people, of course, living in properties with almost no land, and frankly, crammed in left, right and centre. Very often, infrastructure isn't following. And the infrastructure problem means that people are spending a lot on getting around, which is one of the reasons why I continue to analyse cash flow, not just around the mortgage payment or the rental payment, but the total money in, money out, because quite often people in these far-flung areas are just spending a whole lot more just to get around to access services. And quite often, by the way, are also commuting much further. And in some cases, particularly in Western Sydney, are paying massive amounts in tolls just to be able to get into the city. Now, I also model risk of default. Now, risk of default is my forward-looking view of what I think may happen, particularly if things play out in my baseline scenario. And defaults are very low, as I've said. But nevertheless, if you look at, for example, Cranbourne, 3977 in Victoria, there's more than 1,000 households there that are close to the edge and could default over the next 12 months. In fact, the default rate there will be about 5%. In Mandurah, in Western Australia, areas around there, the default rate's even higher at 6.7%, but only 804 there. Now, this is interesting because, of course, you would expect Western Australia to be doing pretty well with the high home prices, but a lot of people bought some years ago and are still leveraged up to the gills. And as a result of that, their cash flow pressures are huge. Then we go to Roxburgh Park, 3064, followed then by Armidale in Western Australia, 6112, Success in Western Australia, 6164, and then Tarnate in Victoria, 3029. Bundaberg in Queensland, 4670, at 5%, still has a risk of default with more than 500 potentially at risk. And Toowoomba, again in Queensland, 4350, another 500 there that could well default over the next 12 months. Derrimut, 3030 in Victoria, a similar sort of count, although a smaller proportion of the total. Gosford on the Central Coast is on the list at 2250, and there more than 500 are in risk. And then we go to Wanneroo, 6065. Coomera in Queensland, 4209. Sampson in Western Australia. And Mount Pleasant and Mackay in Queensland, 4740. And I think it's worth highlighting here that these default stories are showing that it's not just in our major urban centres, but some of the regional areas and also places like the Central Coast. There's a reason for this. People have moved around. People have actually committed themselves when interest rates were a lot lower and then interest rates have been rising. People are hanging out hoping for rate cuts or for increases in income. But of course, now looking at what's happened with Trump and tariffs, the economic scenarios look less rosy than perhaps they ever were. And that's going to put more pressure on more households ahead. So this is something we're going to have to watch very closely in the next 12 months. Remember that default is not necessarily the same as foreclosure. Default means missing a payment. And the banks are quite cautious and careful these days. They don't want to foreclose, so they will extend and pretend. But as I've highlighted before, ASIC's recent report highlighted that the extend and pretend just kick the ball down the road. It doesn't solve the problem at all. Let's now look at rental stress. And here, the postcode with the highest count of those in rental stress is in Liverpool, 2170. With 14,800 in rental stress. Then Toowoomba, 4350, again with more than 14,500. Melbourne, postcode 3000, just over 14,500. Then we go to Southport in Queensland, 4215. Coomera in Queensland, 4209. Westmead in New South Wales, 2145. Campbelltown, 2560. Zetland, 2017. Derrimut, 3030. Bundaberg, 4670 in Queensland, Cranbourne in Victoria, 3977, Tarnet in Victoria, 3029, and Mount Druitt in New South Wales, 2770. And even there in Mount Druitt, we've got more than 9,000 households in financial pressure in the rental sector, which is about 88% of households in the postcode in the rental sector. If we look at the investor story, obviously this is a different cohort and a different story. And at the top of the list, we've got Wembley in Western Australia, 6014, with more than 4,500 stressed investors, about half of those with property. Brumson Beach up in Queensland, 4871, is right up there with a number of investors struggling to make returns. Now here, one of the other factors, I believe, is the recent bad weather and the floods and those sorts of things which are not helping. In Western Australia, in postcode 6149, Bull Creek is up there as well with about 3,200 stressed investors. Westmead in New South Wales, 2145. Narrabeen in New South Wales, 2065. Cranbourne in Victoria, 3977, Toowoomba in Queensland 4350, Rutherford in New South Wales 2320, Paradise Point in Queensland 4216, Bundaberg in Queensland 4670, South Yarra in Victoria 3141, with more than 2,500 investors who are stressed, Randwick in New South Wales 2031, and Yatala in Queensland 4207. And then we can look at the total story with regard to financial stress. This is the aggregate between all the different types of stress. And Toowoomba, postcode 4350, has the prize with more than 28,500 households, or 59%, having cash flow pressures at the moment. Liverpool, postcode 2170, with 28,000, is also next. Then Campbelltown, 2560, Roxburgh Park in Victoria, 3064, Tarnet, Hobbs Crossing, 3029, Derrimut and Point Cook in Victoria, 3030, Cranbourne in Victoria, 3977, Centre of Melbourne, postcode 3000, Ipswich in Queensland, 4305, Mount Druitt in New South Wales, 2770, Wanneroo in Western Australia, 6065, Ballarat, 3350, Westmead in New South Wales at 2145, Blacktown in New South Wales 2148, and Belbird Park and Brookwater in Queensland 4300. And even there, we have around 15,000 households in financial stress, which is about 64% of households in the postcode. So that gives you the top-down view of my latest analysis, and it tells you that not all postcodes are equally pressurized, but there are some where things are looking very dire at the moment. And unfortunately, large cohorts of people have to make really tough decisions about what to spend money on. And in some cases, they're swapping meals for paying somewhere to live, or not going and getting medical treatment, or cutting corners on what they're eating. This is pretty dire. And unfortunately, with the cost of living continuing to rise, this isn't going to get easier anytime soon. Now, the other dimension that we use in our modelling is our scenarios. And I often come back to this to highlight again that scenarios are simply ways of exploring different futures. They are not predictions. They're not forecasts. I'm trying to get to the sensitivities in the economy, not trying to make predictions. None of these scenarios may turn out to be right. Things change. Trump, for example. But we use a framework driven from our core market model. And then we can look at three potential outcomes updated with the latest data and the results and the scenarios running from today looking forward. So here are the current scenarios. I still use the three, but I have made some updates. The best case is the Goldilocks zone, where we see rate cuts in May, and later in the year we see some more cuts. We see the inflation still coming down in line with RBA expectations. We see wage rises faster than inflation. We don't get a recession in Australia, but we still have very strong migration, which remains above average. The second scenario is the base case, which I call the soft landing, where we've got rates staying at 4.1% until later in the year, let's say September. We see a fall in inflation, but then an uptick in inflation later, and it stays stubbornly above the target, the RBA target, that is, until 2026. But we don't get a recession in Australia. On the other hand, we do see a significant fall in migration back to average levels, which, by the way, would be half of what we had over the last 12 months or so. And the worst case scenario, the nightmare scenario, is that we see rates still hanging around 4.1% in 2025 because inflation steps up, but we start to see unemployment rising, wage growth stalls due to the second order trade-led recession that we get here. So we get interest rate cuts later, but it's perhaps all a bit too late. Migration drops below average. So that gives you a sense of the way that these models work. And we could put other scenarios in, but these are the three that I've chosen to use this time. So what's the impact? Well, let's look at Victoria, which of course is an area where people have been saying, oh, Victoria's due for a considerable correction up because prices have dropped so far down. Well, in the best case scenario, sure, I think there could be a rise in home prices of perhaps 5% over the next 2 to 3 years. This is a cumulative 5%. On the base case, there is still chances of more likely to be a fall, about 15% over 3 years, and the worst case, a more considerable fall. Now, as to where we end up, obviously it depends very much on what happens internationally with the trade issues, as well as locally and what the responses are. But I have my doubts that we're going to see strong price growth in Victoria over the next 2 or 3 years, even in the best case scenario. Units tend to follow on pretty closely, by the way, perhaps falling a little less severely. If we then look at Tasmania, again, an area where people have been suggesting that maybe there's going to be some improvement. Well, again, I'm seeing 4.9% over 3 years, best case scenario. I'm seeing a fall of about 15% 3 years on the base case for houses, and the worst case, a more considerable fall, and units following on quite consistently. If I then look in New South Wales, there is definitely an upside story here, potentially with perhaps a 12% increase over the next 3 years for houses. That's the best case. The base case will be a small fall of about 7% over 3 years, and the worst case, a fall of around 29%. For units, again, a rather similar scenario, although the falls would be perhaps a little less severe. If we then look in the Northern Territory, this is a dubious set of numbers because the total property base is so small and the sensitivities in the sample means that there could be significant error rates. But nevertheless, there is some upside on the best case. The base case says sideways. The worst case, a fall, and units pretty much following along. For Queensland, the best case is still further rises, maybe 18% over the next 3 years, with 7% over the next 12 months. But that's the best case. The base case, more like flat, and the worst case, a fall, units following on. And looking at Western Australia, again, potentially we see a rise, maybe 21% over 3 years on the best case scenario for houses. The base case, a bit of an up and then a down, and the worst case, a more considerable down, and units following on pretty much. And then finally, let's just look at the ACT. Again, a small sample, but there's a small rise, 6% over 3 years, base case. Base case, a fall of 14%, worst case, a fall of around 35%, and units following on. And I make the point, I think, that the downside here, if in fact jobs in Canberra are cut by an incoming Conservative government, that could put more downward pressure on prices in the ACT. Now, of course, these scenarios are just indicative, but it shows you some of the sensitivities. And as the economic data changes, we'll update the scenarios. The beauty of my modelling, of course, is that it's all done down at a granular postcode level. And here's my standard example. This is actually for the postcode 2500 around Wollongong, one I know very well. And this is a granularity we'll get to on our next show, where we can look in detail at the number of households in the postcode, how many own a property outright, how many are borrowing, how many are renting. We can look at the levels of stress, both mortgage stress, rental stress, investor stress, and overall financial stress. We can look at the property mix. We can look at the structure of households through the people ratio, the vacancy rates, the gross and net investment yields, the taxable income from the ATO and from the census, the calculation of the disposable monthly income. Remember, I'm talking disposable monthly, not the theoretical before tax. And then I'm looking at what proportion is going on the typical mortgage. In this example, 41.4%, or $2,467 a month for the average mortgage. On the rent, about a third, 33.5%, $1,993. And then taking all of this into account, we can run our scenarios and both look at units and houses in terms of the next 3 years, a cumulative view. So here we're suggesting that the best case scenario, there's still rise possible, 13% for houses, 11% for units. On the baseline scenario, a fall of 7 and 6, respectively. And the worst case, down 28 or 24%. This is the sort of granularity which you can see on my main show. Again, if you've got a particular postcode you'd like me to look at in detail, feel free to put it in the comments and I'll try and cover it. And come on live and ask me live as well. And by the way, if you are interested in both supporting me but also getting access specifically to the data set here, I cover more than 2,000 postcodes every month. You can do that via our Patreon program. In fact, there are different tiers of membership. Thank you very much for all those who support us on a regular basis. It really does help us to be able to cover the costs of what we do. But specifically, if you're interested in the analysis down at the postcode level, these are US dollars, $50 a month plus GST is the price. And you can sign up for a month or you can sign up to receive every month that you are subscribed, you'll receive this data, and it gives you the full spreadsheet underpinning the charts that I've been using. And I find that quite often people like to use this data, for example, to pick particular areas where they're interested, perhaps in looking at property or trying to work out where they compare with other people in the particular area. And of course, this analysis also quite often is covered in the mainstream media, and again, that information is accessible to you via our Patreon program. Now, as I come to the end of the show, I will just make a couple of broader points. The first is, as I always say, if you do have financial pressures, particularly now, it's important to try and get to understand them. Unfortunately, quite a lot of people that we survey really don't have a good handle on how their finances are faring, money in, money out. So building a cash flow is pretty important so that you can actually keep a track of it and then prioritize appropriately. And interestingly, I've been able to help indirectly some people really get to terms with their finances, look to see where the money's going and ask whether the money's going in the right place or not. Now, if you need help, it's very important to go to the right source. And I recommend the National Debt Helpline. That's 1-800-007-007. This is the government-backed and funded scheme, of course. They are very, very busy at the moment, but nevertheless, they are by far the best source of help. Don't just Google help, financial advice, or anything like that, because you'll end up falling into the trap of paying for advice and potentially expending a lot more money than you should. There are unfortunately cowboys out there who exploit people in financial difficulty. So be careful, be cautious. But that National Helpline is a good source of structured help. And talking about structured help, I'll also must mention the AFCA, Statement of Financial Position tool. This is available from the AFCA website. And interestingly, this helps people parse how their finances are behaving, because it asks you to think about your household income, your living expenses, the property, other assets, the debts, and even steers you towards thinking about what you would need to do. And this can be really helpful, firstly, for your own use, to be able to get to where your finances really are rather than where you think it is. And then secondly, if you do have an issue and you need to talk to the bank or indeed talk to a debt counsellor, this information can be a very valuable source of information to be able to be going through it in a structured way. Because what I find quite often is that people get into some difficulty trying to understand how to deal with their finances. And, you know, top line is, if you have high interest rate debts, pay those off first. Consider your discretionary spending. You know, what's really important? Are all those Netflix subscriptions and things really that important? Maybe the mobile phone plan you've got could be skinned. I mean, there are things that people can do. Unfortunately, quite often what I find, both in my surveys and in my one-to-ones, that some people really just put their head in the sand and hope things will get better. But frankly, knowing what I know and seeing what I see at the moment, I think household finances are going to be under pressure for quite some time. And as I said at the top of the show, the politicians really aren't trying to address the critical issues that should be addressed. So there is really no direct way out of the pressure. And by the way, just refinancing a mortgage or borrowing more isn't necessarily the solution. It's about behavior, it's about prioritization, and it's about trying to take some of those tough decisions. And sometimes I know people don't want to take those tough decisions. They want to kick the can down, assume a bit more debt will be fine. But certainly in my modeling, what I do see is this downward spiral. The people get into a cash flow pressure. They then refinance. They then borrow more. But ultimately, they continue to spiral down because they don't necessarily take the strategic steps that they need to. And I've said, and I say it again, that we can't rely on the government to get us out of this mess. We can't rely on RBA cuts and rates to get us out of this mess. This is a strategic problem that's been created by many years of bad policy, which then comes directly back to what I started at the start of the show, that the problem that I see is that the politicians really don't want to talk about the critical issues. They prefer to deflect. They prefer to bribe prospective voters with a little bit of splashing and cashing, but not dealing with the critical issues that we face as a nation. And that's a problem because structurally, we do have some very important opportunities in Australia. Of course, we have the resources and we have the land and everything else, but unfortunately, the opportunity is being squandered. It has been squandered through to bad policy, due to bad policy over the last 20 to 30 years, particularly. And we're reaping the whirlwind, I'm afraid, at the moment. So it is time, I think, for a change. And as I've said on previous shows, maybe just some thinking harder about who to vote for is worth spending the time thinking about. And just to recap, if you'd like to join me on my live show on Tuesday, it's at 8 p.m. Sydney time. And there I'll be going through the postcode analysis and specifically homing in on where the households are hurting the most. And if there's a particular postcode you'd like me to analyze, you can come on live and ask for it live. Or if it's easier, put it in the chat and I'll make sure it's covered on Tuesday. So the bottom line is this, that we have many households who are in significant financial peril at the moment. And I don't believe that the political dialogue so far through this election campaign is coming anywhere close to tackling some of the structural issues that we have. Shame on them, but maybe also shame on us for not putting more pressure back on them. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.